Well, welcome back to another edition of Stock Talk. I'm Todd Martin, along with my colleague, Catherine Franz. And seems like it's been a while since we've done this, Catherine.
It has. It has been quite a while. We've been running the sponsorship podcast from the annual conference, you know, here and there. And so that kind of allowed us to, I guess you can say take a break, but I've missed it. So I'm glad we're back.
I've missed it too. So we're not going to do that anymore. We're just going to jump in and have to go in and keep doing this regardless of all that stuff.
Perfect.
So let's see. I am not in Fayetteville, Arkansas this week. I am in Montana, and I look junky because I did go fishing this morning, but got back in time, just in time to do Stock Talk, and I'm trying to re-zip my shirt over here. Screw it. We'll leave it alone. Got back just in time to do this edition of Stock Talk, and I am thrilled to say that we are joined by Elizabeth Burns Thompson, or EBT, as I understand, from the Modern Ag Alliance. So, EBT, welcome.
Thank you, Todd and Kat, for having me on today, and appreciate IPSA's partnership as part of our initiative, too, at Modern Ag.
You bet. You know what? It took us a little bit of time to really get involved with Modern Ag. And, you know, when we really sat down and started looking at the problems and everything that Modern Ag is addressing, it became a real no-brainer, especially for us looking at our own constituents and the dangers that are sitting out there. But, you know, what we're going to be talking about today is going to be glyphosate and Roundup and some of the actions that are going on nationally. I think everybody that is going to be listening to our podcast knows that there have been innumerable lawsuits against Bayer today with regards to glyphosate, and they're coming out in multi-million dollar judgments in a lot of cases. Bayer, I know, has prevailed in some, but I think that what we want to talk about today is to really drive down into what Modern Ag Alliance is doing and kind of the what I'm going to call the truth behind the screen of the lawsuits, which I think that people have a wrong assumption about what's going on there. So let's just start out kind of level set. Can you tell us a little bit about Modern Ag Alliance?
Absolutely. And just probably start not only the organization, but myself, hopefully much like many of the listeners and your members. I, too, come from, you know, ag background. My family still farms in the eastern part of the state of Iowa. So I am a proud Iowa State Cyclone alumni of the College of Ag, and actually went on and did some work in agricultural law as well. Have spent much of my career doing ag policy for a variety of commodity groups and trade associations. So, you know, it's humbling to me to be able to now lead an organization that works so closely with other trade groups and associations like yours here today. So I joined the group Modern Ag in January of this year. So we're coming up just on 6 months, and it's been an eventful 6 months. But Modern Ag is a little over a year old as well. So we were formed to really at our core proactively begin to play some offense in the space of crop protection tools, right? We saw growing threats, and I say we, agriculture broadly, saw, you know, this increasing amount of threats to the availability and continued access to these tools. And when we're talking about tools, obviously these critical chemistries. Glyphosate's on the forefront of so many folks' minds here today. That's what we spend a lot of time talking about. But really what we're working towards is chemistry and company agnostic, right? So the solutions that we are teeing up at the state level and now working towards some federal activity, which I'm sure we'll talk about here as well, is at its fundamental core, making sure that farmers have access to not only the tools and technologies of today, these critical chemistries, but also that we're setting place, you know, a regulatory environment that is conducive for manufacturers to want to be able to bring forth new tools and new chemistries, right? When we're thinking about what the next generation is going to have in their toolbox, we certainly don't want them to be dealing with less.
Well, okay, so let's dive into that. And I really want to start out with the glyphosate piece because it is seemingly at the forefront of this battle, tip of the spear, if you will. But as we look at some of the things going on with Roundup, and I think that I will say we went through a period where there was hardly a week go by that there was not a major story that was national in farm press with regards to another lawsuit against Roundup, another multi-million dollar judgment. And there were a whole lot of things that as this first started coming out, I think a lot of people said, okay, so, you know, they found out Roundup's a carcinogen and now people are getting cancer. And yes, these people need to be protected. I think there was a mindset about like that. But that's just not the truth, is it?
I appreciate the opportunity to do some fact checking.
This is what we call in the biz a softball for you.
There you go. Yes. And I think, you know, I do believe brevity is an art form, but we do need to do a little bit of let's go back in time. And we don't have to go too far back in time to be able to paint a picture of how we got to where we are today. So if you back up about 10 years, we saw a report come out of a sub-agency out of the WHO, the World Health Organization, that deemed glyphosate, amongst a variety of other things, unfortunately, as a possible or probable carcinogen. I think possible is the technical classification they've given. What many people don't realize is that there are relatively nothing that agency has looked at that hasn't been given some level of carcinogenicity classification, right? I truly think that there's like one component piece, and it's the stretchy stuff in our spandex leggings, thank goodness, because I do wear a handful of those, that was the only thing that they haven't deemed to have some level of carcinogenicity or a potential for cancer causing, right? The unfortunate piece about that, well, there's a number of things, but if you think about what they're putting Roundup alongside or glyphosate, it's things like red meat, hot coffee, working the night shift. The list goes on, right? Things that are not only critical pieces of many of you know my everyday life and our kind of overall society, but we know, you know, can be debunked and have been debunked over. That, you know, there's a lot that we could go into talking about the WHO and the wherewithal behind that entity and why the U.S. is no longer part of that organization anymore either. But what that cascaded into, just for the sake of kind of painting the picture of how we got here, is created a movement in places like California and other states that move forward with propositions, specifically Prop 65 is what I'm going to point to out of California, that required labels on products that IARC or these agencies had deemed as, you know, probable or possible carcinogens. So that's why on the back of, you know, picture frames or certain, you know, consumer products, you'll see these little disclaimer labels. That actually was overturned by the Ninth Circuit Court there in the kind of western part of the United States because they recognized that we have such a robust labeling process and review process by the EPA in this country. So California's attempt to change the labeling of products was actually overturned. What that unfortunately opened up, though, was a legal loophole, or so the legal community thought, to be able to try to cast a shadow of a doubt about how we do labeling and review of these products, you know, moving forward. And that is really where the onset of litigation started to transpire and has had a groundswell since then. And Todd, you teed it up just right, and we can, not only can we go to, you know, law school one-on-one on how we got here, but we can certainly walk through the legal component pieces of this well and kind of simplify it down. But most of this litigation, if not nearly all of this litigation, is focused on the question of what is or is not present on a label. It's not regarding product harm or things like that. It is truly a question of whether or not certain things can or cannot or should not be on a product label.
Okay, so let's dive into that just a little bit. What you're saying to me, what I'm hearing you say, and what that means to me is that we have a federal guideline through the EPA. Now, you can love and hate the EPA, and I can tell you at different times I've always hated the EPA, so I can't say I actually loved them occasionally. No, I've always pretty much been at odds with the EPA, but regardless of that, there is a robust situation with regards to labeling and testing that has to go through. So the EPA says this is what has to be on the label. It does not include anything from a carcinogenic property because, in Roundup's case, because testing has shown conclusively, it's not carcinogenic. I do have to say, so that's one aspect. And then we have court cases that are legitimately saying, oh, no, that's not right. They should have warned people that it's cancer causing.
Absolutely. And I think we've probably teed up what is the, if there's one thing that folks can take away from this session, you know, this is the one thing I want them to remember, which is agriculture as a whole right now sits between what I would call a rock and a hard place or an untenable situation, however you want to tee it up. On one side of the coin, you have the legal industry, the legal community, trial lawyers, and Block that have said, we are going to continue to sue you until you add disclaimers or additional component pieces to your label. On the other side of that coin, or the, you know, rock/hard place, you have the regulator, and I happen to have that handy, so I'll just read it word for word, that says the EPA will no longer approve product labels claiming glyphosate is known to cause cancer. It's a false claim that does not meet the labeling requirements of FIFRA, which is our guiding principle. There is not a position. So basically, there is not a way in which manufacturers can move forward. If they label it, the EPA says they could be deemed misbranded and that product is pulled from the shelves, or they acquiesce to litigation moving forward. So at the end of the day, what we are working on,
a rock and hard place. EPA is one thing, you have to do this, and the people are suing you on the other side saying you have to do this, and you can't do either.
It is the epitome, like I said, that I have found of rock and hard place, which is why I think you've seen such a groundswell of interest from, you know, the ag industry broadly, right? We're talking coast to coast. Every commodity that I know of is involved in these conversations, in part because, you know, like we talked about before, it's glyphosate today, just because it's one component or one chemistry, they're setting up what we think could be very much a bellwether for what every other chemistry that's on the market today and or anything that's moving through the R&D pipeline stands to face. And you're talking about, you know, big dollars and big amount of time for a product to come from an idea in a lab to a product on a shelf.
Well, so most people that know me know that I came up in the industry through Sibagaigi and spent 25 years at Syngenta through its legacy companies before coming over to work with IFSA 10 years ago. So long history with regards to crop protection products. And in particular, you know, I was very fortunate to see the rise of biotechnology in that entire revolution and the way that Roundup Ready MBT basically changed the way that things are done and the benefits that farmers directly derive from them. Out of that, from regaining lives to, you know, ease of use to all kinds of stuff. So when I look at that, one of the things that we used to say, and, you know, was that, look, because at one time at the merger of Novartis and Zeneca that formed Syngenta, we started selling a couple of different glyphosate brands ourselves. And it, look, glyphosate is a salt. It's the same, you know, it's a salt like table salt. You use table salt in excess, yeah, it's not good for you. You use glyphosate in excess, it's not good. But it's a salt. It's safe. And, you know, by and large, that's the mindset that I have come up through. And I still embrace that mindset, that I believe inherently that it is a safe product. I use it around my home. I use it smartly, although I have been known to, you know, spray errant grass in flip-flops and short pants. But I guess there are two things that come into me. One, I do believe it's safe, and I do believe that you should use it properly. Two, the real concern that I have is the community that would be at risk if it were not safe should be the agriculture community. And I seem to recall not seeing any farmers suing Bayer or having most of the people I see that are in these lawsuits and litigation are non-agriculture people.
And you know, I will tell you, not being an employee for any one of the manufacturers, I can't speak to the specifics of the lawsuits in bulk. But I do understand, you know, that anecdotally a larger block of the plaintiffs that have brought these types of cases are coming from the home and garden sector or landscaping sector than what you're seeing come from the agricultural sector. So there is some truth to kind of where most of this is coming from, yes. But at the end of the day, you're right. We have to have, you know, some trust in science. We have to have some trust in a process. And it, even I agree with you, you know, I've spent many years in the ag industry, and more often than not, you know, the agencies and block have been challenging, be it, you know, name your issue of the day. You know, we've had challenges with agencies or the understanding of how production ag works, but generally it's because they're so rigorous. And in this case, the rigor of scientific analysis that goes into, you know, product registration, which is the process that a chemistry goes through before it can come to market. You know, we're not talking about a matter of days or months. We're talking about years, if not decades. I think the average that we've looked at over time is that it's about a $300 million investment of company resources, right, to bring a product or a new product through a registration process, as well as like between 10 to 12 years. And that's just amazing, you know, and that comes, I would say, slows down significant, if not to a screeching halt, if we also then have to tack on $10, $20 billion of legal challenges after the fact, when you successfully bring a product through those review process, and then also successfully re-register it over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm. No, and look, 100% understand that piece of it. I immediately think about an old Subagai product, atrazine, that's been on the market, you know, since the 40s. And it's been, I mean, prior to biotechnology coming in and Roundup Ready becoming the predominant technology, you know, in the row crop area, atrazine was the heaviest used, you know, chemical out there. And of course, for years, part of, you know, Subagai, the Novartis and Syngenta's policy has been groundwater monitoring through atrazine and in that. And yet with this type of approach on crop protection chemicals, as long as glyphosate has been out there and been studied, I mean, all of a sudden, what's the next step, as you said, of products that are going to be attacked? What's the next thing that somebody's going to say, oh, this, I used this and this happened. So to me, it becomes, you know, initially this is a Roundup focused piece, but like you said, in the very beginning, EBT, this also is going to widely impact everybody else, not just from new chemistries, but from old standby chemistries that we've had literal decades of use that we could also lose as tools for farming.
Absolutely. And like I mentioned before, I think, like I said, our members, yourself and others, definitely see this as, call it a playbook or a bellwether of what every other chemistry has to, you know, stands to face. Not only those ones that have been on the market since, you know, our parents were farming, but anything that's new in the R&D pipeline right now, I think is seeing an extremely uphill battle based on the landscape, which is unfortunate too, because, you know, we live in an environment where, you know, technology and innovation is what we're fostering, right? We're looking at how do we bring even more manufacturing into this country and, you know, innovation and efficiencies. And one could argue that the legal dynamic that we have right now is not only, stifling it is an understatement. It's cutting it off at the knees.
So let's change gears just a little bit here. And what can we do? Modern Ag Alliance has been very involved. I know that we have written one article, you know, to our membership with y'all's help, and thank you for that. Mm-hmm. But how do we get the messaging out? But just beyond the messaging, concretely, I know that Modern Ag Alliance has backed some state regulations and bills that have gone through several different states with regards to, I'm going to say truth in labeling, but that's not quite it. Uniformity of labeling, mm-hmm, at the federal label. Can you speak to exactly what is being done?
Absolutely. And I think a key piece of this, like we talked about at the onset, is we want to play some offense. I think in all too often we wait until we've lost a product or we've lost access to a market or we've, you know, something's been taken away to try to fight to get it back. And I think this is an initial set of agriculture saying, we're not going to wait until these products are taken away from us. We're going to start proactively working on, you know, playing offense. And so that is really what we have been working to do at the state level thus far and growing into some federal efforts. So you mentioned we proactively have worked on some legislative solutions. Regulatory clarity, labeling consistency, they've come by a lot of different names. At the end of the day, it really is consistency and clarity on labeling. Unfortunately, I hate using the opposition's terminology, but these have been also misbranded a lot of different other things, and they are truly not removing responsibilities or any type of indemnification. And I want to take a point to be able to, we're going to take your listeners to a 60 seconds of law school 101 that I think is important to be able to.
Now, I do have to ask, since you are a lawyer and you mentioned ag law.
Yes.
Surely you know my good friend Harrison Pittman at the University of Arkansas and the Ag Law Center, right?
I have known Harrison since I was a student in law school. I did an internship with the Ag Law Center back in the day.
Oh, so you're kidding. Did you really?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Him and the Rumleys, Beth and Rusty down there, they have a fantastic team at the center. So I think very highly of them.
Well, that's tremendous. They're good friends. So I you said ag law. I figured, okay, yeah, there's got to be a connection here.
Absolutely. And so just for the sake of kind of a foundational building block, and this is an important concept, regardless of whether we're talking about pesticides, tractors, or the chairs that we're sitting on, or the pen that's in my hand right now, right? Any manufacturer has three basic responsibilities under products liability, which is what we're talking about when we're working on these legislative solutions. And that is, one, you must design a safe and effective product. So you must, it must do what it's intended to do, right? This pen better write, and it better do so without, exploding all over my hand, right? That is one leg of that stool. And if you don't do or upstand to those responsibilities, there's a cause of action. And when I say cause of action, a pathway to the courthouse to be able to be made whole, right? Second responsibility, you must manufacture something according to those design standards, right? So I designed it to do what it needs to do, and then I actually made it according to that. So if the manufacturer of the chair that I'm sitting on decided to put three bolts in it as opposed to four, and I fall down, there's a cause of action for that, right? That's the second leg of that stool, independent from any of these others. The third leg of the product's liability stool, or the third responsibility of every manufacturer, is you must label or warn of known or inherent dangers, right? So if, there's probably a sticker on this bottom of this chair that says, don't lean back too far, or don't lean back at all, right? That's not the intended use. Or, don't leave this pen in a hot environment, the ink might explode. So, things like that. Those three legs of the stool, three responsibilities, exist the same today as they would after all of our solutions are put into law. What we are narrowly focused on is that third leg of the stool, right? What is the standard, or how does a company satisfy their responsibility around warning labels? The other two pieces remain unchanged, right? A company still has the responsibility to have a product that's safe and does what it's intended to do, and they still must make it according to those design standards. The only thing that we're working on clarifying is what necessarily is or is not on a label.
Okay, so you've gone to state legislatures, or there have been state legislatures that have taken action currently.
Yes, so we've put forward proactive solutions.
Where are the states? We
went into about a dozen states this spring, everywhere from Montana to North Carolina, from Florida to Bismarck, North Dakota. We got very close in some places, and maybe not as close in others, but we did get a couple completely across the finish line I'm very excited about. So both the state of North Dakota as well as the state of Georgia enacted, so far, right? There's still some legislatures at this point that are still considering some. But at this point, we do have two states that have enacted this and it's been signed into law by the governor, and that is both Georgia and North Dakota. So they are really leading the example for, what I would argue other state legislative bodies across the country. And we're going to continue to have robust conversations with lawmakers, going into 2026. Additionally, what I think is an important kind of complementary effort, both this summer and fall, as well, is that taking this and having similar conversations with Congress, because there was also, when I say Congress, U.S. Congress, obviously, a ag labeling uniformity act that was introduced in the last Congress that we understand, has a lot of interest, bipartisan interest yet again, to be reintroduced in this Congress. It was actually part of the House Farm Bill, the last cycle. We know that we are still in this Groundhog Day of Farm Bill conversations. So
yeah, we are.
I have no idea as to whether or not we see a Farm Bill this year. But we do know that obviously it got the attention and legs and wherewithal as part of that conversation last year. So we do anticipate to have some robust conversations about that, you know, into this year. In addition to, I think, something that's on the top of mind of a lot of growers, a lot of people in agribusiness, and a lot of consumers is, you know, the MAHA, or the Make America Healthy Again report that we saw come out of DC just a few weeks ago, which I think rightfully so draw some questioning eyes from a lot, especially in the ag space.
Yeah, I want to come back to that, but before we go to there, so two states that I did follow a lot, Missouri and Iowa, in proximity from Northwest Arkansas.
Yep.
Where do they currently stand? I know that, I want to say in both, they got very close. Is that kind of on hold at this point? Is it still progressing? What's the current situation, both Missouri and Iowa?
Yep, both of those states have adjourned for this cycle or this session, but we did make it through a full body in each chamber. So, I should say in each state. So we've made it halfway through the process, I guess you could say. In some states, like the state, my home state of Iowa, that allows us to pick right up next year where we left off. So we already have passage on the Senate, full Senate side. So we'll move into the House side and really focus on conversations there. You know, the same could be said in Tennessee, where we made it all the way through the Senate, and we just have one more committee on the House side, as well as a House floor vote. So, you know, I would say good policy sometimes takes time. I fully also recognize, you know, there's a reason this podcast is taking us, you know, 30 or 40 minutes to work through, because these are not
they're not easy issues.
They're not simple. They're not simple issues. As intuitive as it is, once you get kind of a broader understanding of the dynamics, they're new acronyms, they're new spaces. It's, you know, legal complexities that need to be talked through and understood before you can get into those solutions. And those things just frankly take time.
Well, and let's face it, it does come back to that very thing. If someone is assuming that these are happening because of health, it's these judgments are occurring because of labeling.
Correct.
It doesn't have anything to do with the other. It
yep.
is about labeling. And that's, if the labeling were off the table, the outcomes would be different. So, you know, that's when I look at this, I think that that's the important walk away for me, is it is about labeling. And
absolutely.
From that standpoint, that is something that can be fixed. You know, one way or the other, it can be fixed, and it should be fixed. But, you know, to just allow this unrelenting litigation to continue based over that issue is ridiculous.
It is. And I think, you know, just I do think it's worth maybe taking a pause and saying, you know, for those that have been affected by cancer or some of these other diseases that there's been conversations talked about in relation to products, like, I want people to know very clear that it is important that we continue to have processes that people that are injured by products are able to be made whole, right? Mm-hmm. And if science evolves or something changes such that products are found to have caused harm, that there is still a process that individuals can be made whole. And that is not only important to me as someone whose family is involved in production agriculture, but also as someone that, you know, is a member of the legal community as well. I think it's incumbent upon our legal system to ensure that we provide those pathways. But I also understand that the solutions that we are working on still preserve those. It also just is ensuring that we're providing the clarity and consistency that manufacturers deserve, that retailers deserve, that agriculture deserves, and frankly, that consumers deserve. Because consistency around labeling, you know, health and safety or the provisions of a label, whether you're in Montana or, you know, Arkansas or Maine, right, that necessarily should be consistent because health and safety doesn't know time zones. It doesn't know state lines. It doesn't know commodities, right? Like a product is safe or it's not, and the component pieces on warnings necessarily should be consistent. And that's what we're working towards.
Well, and I very much appreciate you saying that because I totally agree. I'm a cancer survivor myself from 11 years ago. So I'm very happy that I'm cancer free today. But, you know, so those remedies need to be there. But I think that it is the situation that, okay, if that is the situation, yes, people need to be taken care of. This is just not that situation. I think one of the things that I came to that I wanted to talk to, and this is a little bit of the transition right before we go to the MAHA report. I've heard this a couple of different times, and I think just bluntly to say it is there are people out there that are, I have heard relate this issue to big tobacco. And what I mean by that is, let's face it, when the tobacco litigations came out, there were smoking guns in tobacco where obviously big tobacco knew that, you know, tobacco caused cancer and cigarettes were bad and kind of hid that from the public. This is not that. I mean, no, this is not that situation or anything similar. There is nothing like that that's in existence. This has been, glyphosate has been studied and studied and studied. And yes, there's one thing from an international body that out there that says, okay, we think it could cause, that's one study against thousands, literally, that would proclaim the opposite. Is that an accurate statement?
Yes, and I'd say not only thousands of studies, thousands of both independent studies, right? We're not talking about just company-based research. We're talking about independent entities that have looked at this product. And it's not just in recent years. These products are re-registered, at least in the United States, at least every 15 years. I'm going to say it again, at least, because in many cases, the EPA is looking at them even far more, you know, on a shorter time period, I should say, than every 15 years. And also, you know, this is, in the case of glyphosate, something that's used around the world and has uniformly been registered under the dynamics and regulatory schemes that have different thresholds and standards than we even have in the U.S. too, right? And that's something that they continue to recognize, not only the safety of, the efficacy of, but the importance of to production agriculture, right? And we have data points to be able to showcase, you know, just how impactful this is to, you know, the American food supply, our fuel supply, our, you know, we have been blessed in this country to be able to have the tools and resources to ensure that people can put food on the table and fuel in their tank and fiber on their backs, right, in a fashion that doesn't break us. So we want to be able to do that moving forward. And that is incumbent upon having tools like glyphosate. The other piece that I think it shocks me that this doesn't get more attention is that we've also driven to not only doing a lot with a little, but how do we do so that we're preserving, you know, our natural resources? So that whole conversation around conservation, we don't have no-till without tools like glyphosate and other chemistries, right? That has unlocked the ability for the American farmer to do even more, if not exponentially more, in the space of conservation. And I think people just don't, unfortunately, are not connecting the dots on those two things.
No, agreed. Totally agree. Let's move over to MAHA. Modern Ag Alliance sent a letter, you know, around the Make America Healthy Again report. IPSA signed on with y'all with regards to that. The report came out and, Let's see. I guess the way I would say it is, from my perspective, considering RFK Jr., the report came out pretty much with exactly what I thought it would be, which is it's a clear attack on everything that it felt like a clear attack to me on everything that we're doing in ag. And I don't know, you're much better versed than I am on this. So why don't you give us a little bit of a rundown and, you know, let's talk about really what we could do and what the potential impacts of this report are.
I'd also like to know what your initial reaction was to when it came out.
Yeah. So I initially, I was waiting with bated breath, right? Like many others, for the publication of this. I think, you know, just from a foundation for those of the listeners that maybe don't know how this fits in the context or kind of the background behind this. So the president did sign, you know, an executive order creating this Make America Healthy Again Commission, which is tasked with really two major kind of milestone pieces. We saw the first of that being with this initial report here a couple weeks ago. Yes. It's been 2 weeks. It feels like it's been longer than that almost. But we saw the initial piece of that. And their directive was to look for or evaluate factors on that are affecting, you know, child health crisis in this country. You teed it up very well, Todd. I think we all knew, you know, throughout both RFK prior to being a politician. He is a trial attorney at his core. He, in fact, was part of the very first Roundup litigation. So I would have been very surprised to not see that mentioned. Throughout as his time as a candidate, he made it very clear that he saw pesticides as a problem. And that was echoed, I think, when we saw this initial report come out here a couple weeks ago. What gives me even more concern, in addition to the fact of how much pesticides are being put on the target within this 68-page document, is that this is just the first step, right? These are just an identifier of targets or factors. The second report that we expect to get in August is their tactics or what their action steps are associated with that. So we didn't see, you know, obviously in this of what the administration necessarily wants to do about some of these things. We just know that the foundation that they're laying is that their eyes are on crop protection tools, specifically some of the chemistries that are most widely used in this country by Production Act. So, you know, I think you saw broad ranging concern expressed from the ag community holistically that, you know, the way we go about doing things in the ag space is being questioned, very deeply questioned. And I think there's a lack of, I know in this country, there's a lack of understanding of what we do, how we do it, and largely why we do it. And so many of probably your listeners are like myself in that we had the benefit of growing up on a farm and being around agriculture, right? We saw a crop go in. We see it come out in the fall. We've been around livestock. And so we just have an intuitive understanding of how and why and the tools. But most of America doesn't have the benefit of that. And so we're seeing that reflected, unfortunately, in the policymaking. And I'm very concerned that the tactics then that will come out later this year will be bad. I can't think of another way else to put it.
Well, and there's a piece here that I sit down and I think, you know, again, that the dichotomy of the administration. On the one hand, the president has made it very clear that deregulation is in his agenda. And, you know, with the moves that he's taken, and I'll take with Secretary Zeldin at EPA, they are deregulating and they are moving that direction. I look at some of the things that are going on with APHIS and USDA, and they are deregulating. And I don't think that people in general have really understood how much regulation. We all think regulation, okay, well, it's done for safety features, but how much of it has really become just overburdensome to getting anything done. And I have to say, from my own experience, having dealt more with the more in the governmental areas over the last 5 years, I have been shocked at how difficult it is to get things done and using a common sense approach. So I bring that to come back and say, okay, it seems that Maha's only option is to overregulate everything under the sun, which seems to be very opposed to President Trump's overall view of the world from a regulation standpoint. So, you know, I take some solace in that and some comfort to say that, yeah, this is going to be a real uphill battle for RFK Jr. and his whole approach. However, also scared to death of what he might be able to bring forward. The ideas that I've heard him espouse and production ag, oh, we'll do this. And I mean, I don't think the world's going to be able to go to organic farming without a bunch of people starving to death. And, you know, I've just grown up in this environment of production ag and seeing the modern tools that we have employed in production ag enable a productivity of farmers in the United States to be unparalleled in the history of the world. And so now what are we going to do? We're going to say, oh, well, all of these are bad. Starvation's bad too, you know, from that perspective. Now, red dye number 40 or whatever it is. Yeah. Okay. Can we do without that? Catherine would say yes. In a big way.
I don't care about red dye. I was just testing it. But I do want to go back to this piece because this is the second time this week that I have had or been a part of a conversation of how the general public has no idea what agriculture does in this country. So, or even the world, honestly. So what are y'all doing or what suggestions do you have to get that education out there? I mean, obviously talking is good, right? You know, doing things like this podcast or social media or newsletters. I mean, all of that's good, but it's almost like a battle that is so big. How do you even start to fight that?
I think that it's important to say that you can be pro modern agriculture and pro Maha, right? Like you can want to be healthy and actively agree with so many of those things. And I think it's important that we continue to work towards, you know, some of the key tenets and the goals. It's the tactics, right? And the tactics are shaped by having a broad understanding of, back to that point, of what, why, what, how, and why. And to your point, telling your story, but it's to members of Congress, it's to your state lawmakers, it's to your county commissioners. I think you just can't take it for granted that people understand how and why you do it that way. And frankly, why certain tools are important, because it isn't intuitive to not only the Joe Publics of the world, but the people that are making the rules or the regulatory environments that we're going to operate in moving forward. And Todd, to a point that you made a little bit earlier, you know, I think the piece that stands out to me personally is that we've worked so hard in agriculture to build out the opportunity for consumer choice, right? Not villainizing, you know, I'm not sure if that's actually a word. I might have made that up, but villainizing.
Villainizing is a word. I don't think it's a word.
That there is not necessarily like a right or wrong way, but we want you to be able to have the choice. And if there are certain things that you feel more comfortable, you know, buying at the grocery store versus others, or at the fuel tank, or that when it comes to, you know, the clothes that you buy, choice is important. And that's a key piece of what this country kind of is predicated upon. Mm-hmm. And that is also what concerns me about, you know, some of the pieces that's in this report, because it does feel like they're drawing strong lines about a right and a wrong way to farm, which will lead to a right and wrong food choice and things like that on things where, you know, we want choice.
I think, and to that point, I mean, it really and truly, I was, this was about a year and a half ago, and I was with two groups, and we were talking about an overall farm level program to initiate with farmers. And it happened to be around sustainability in this case. And I mean, you know, carbon sequestration and everything else that farmers can do. And literally, this organization that was supposed to be farmer centric use terms like good farmers and bad farmers around farmers choosing certain sustainability practices or not. And I was stunned over this. And they continued through this entire meeting with regards to good farmers and bad farmers. And, you know, that's a little bit of the concept that I see coming in here, you know, from Maha, good farmers, bad farmers. That's just wrong. There are not good actors and bad actors in farming. There are farmers who make different choices for different reasons. And, you know, we've got to respect that from that standpoint. So, yeah, I finally at this particular meeting finally stood up, said, okay, been in farming for a long time, been associated with farmers. I've never met a bad farmer. Good farmers, they're making choices. They may not be choices you agree with, but nonetheless, that it does not mean they're bad farmers. So, you know, I think that's one of the areas that I see the public more who are uninformed about agriculture, which by and large is getting to be a whole lot of our public, even in our elected officials. I see one of the dangers around all of this stuff. They can be convinced too easily that, oh my God, we have to have it this way or else they're just creating stuff that's bad for me. Well,
there's always going to be a fear of unknown. I think it's an intuitive thing that you know, the unknown has a level of fear to it. And that goes, so that is reflected then also in, you know, the production practices associated with our food system today. And so if you can counteract that unknown by educating. And so a key piece of what we've done at Modern Ag too, just to get back to kind of the foundational piece of the organization, I'd say about half of our work is proactively educating, be it, you know, social media ads or, you know, billboards or print advertisements and things like that, or opportunities like this, where we can proactively be able to bring people into a conversation about tools and production practices, and frankly, have the opportunity to meet a farmer so they can ask some of those questions of things. And I think, again, to your point before about, you know, you can't take it for granted that people understand, you know, how things work. They just don't.
And I think that, you know, not only do we have to educate those who don't know, but we also have to debunk all of the misinformation that's out there too, that spreads like wildfire.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, something I want to lead to this so it doesn't feel, you know, there is a true sense of urgency around these, right? We're talking about, you know, making sure you're having conversations and telling your story, which is something I've been in this industry for, you know, almost 15 years. Like, we've been talking about that since I was in college, right? Tell your story, go out and, you know, I remember getting farmers' Twitter accounts and Facebook pages back in the day, right? So that we could try to start connecting them with the public more. There is a real risk that if you do not tell your story and talk about the importance of why certain things are critical to your operation, that you will lose them. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how more clear to make that, but if you do not stress how important things are, they go away. In fact, my grandpa used to tell me, you know, if you don't take care of it, it'll go away. This is what he would say, you know, to brush your teeth, right? If you ignore it, it'll go away. I think the same could be said about, you know, tools or tactics or things like that. If you ignore stressing the importance and communicating about how tools are effective and important to your operation, they will go away.
So for our listeners, if they had to do one thing to help share their story, what would you suggest that they do?
Develop relationships with their elected officials.
Okay.
At any level of the ladder, and make sure that they see that those officials see them as a resource, so that when you have things like the MAHA report, or when you have things like state legislative proposals, that relationship's intact, and you can very easily say, this is, we need you to work on this, because this is important not only to my farm, but every farm in your district, and frankly, everyone that eats. And last I checked, that's everyone.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. It's important to everyone who eats. Which I so it's very important to me. EBT, one last question as we're trying to get in here, and it kind of plays along with what Catherine just asked. So IFSA's got a lot of independent seed companies that are our members, and we're proud to support Modern Ag Alliance. What about our individual member companies beyond the relationships with their state legislatures, their federal legislators that a lot of them have? What can they do in the community? How can they lean into communications with Modern Ag Alliance? How can we fit some things together there?
Sure. So one, we have a wealth of resources on our website. So those encourage folks to download our fact sheets, incorporate them into things that you're working on, or frankly, invite us out to participate in some of your events too. I love going out and seeing the countryside, meeting with folks, and being able to kind of talk through like what we talk through here today. We can do it in less than an hour, I promise. even though we might not approve that here this afternoon, but kind of draw attention to what is happening in, you know, state capitals and our nation's capital, and how and why their voice is important, be it on the production kind of farmer side of the aisle, the retailer side of the aisle, the agribusiness side of the aisle. I mean, every voice in this process matters.
Well, on that note, and I think that we'll have to carry that message forward and continue to talk with you some more about that. EBT, Elizabeth Burns Thompson from Modern Ag Alliance, thank you for joining us on Stock Talk. Catherine, it's good to be back doing this. So we'll have to do it again here in a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks. Oh, you got to do the other thing, Catherine.
Oh, yes. I always forget. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and share so other people can hear the information as well.
Okay. Well, we'll see you next time. Thank you.
Don't hang up quite yet.